Savitri, Book 7, The Book of Yoga, Canto 4, The Triple Soul Forces. This is part 1. It's on pages 503 through 508. Savitri is coming closer to the cave of the soul. As she traveled on the inner pathway so far, she has seen how necessary it is to have the presence and the influence of her soul in all her ways, inner thinking parts, and feeling and acting. Now she's going to hear the complaint of divine compassion and pity and the cry of suffering and misery when the soul is hidden, when the soul is not active in man's consciousness. Our immortal soul is always kind and caring, wise and loving. Our soul is beyond the negativities of the world, with the world's pain and suffering. And when we are with our soul and our soul is active in us, it helps us to be in the world in the same way. When Savitri first told her parents that she had found her eternal mate, Narad, the great sage and seer of the gods, was there. He had come, particularly he had come, to tell Savitri what she would have to face when she married Satyavan, because Satyavan was going to die in 1 year. 1 year from that very day. Sri Aurobindo wrote, "His words set free the spring of cosmic fate." But Savitri's mother, the queen, was really upset, thinking that her daughter, her beloved child, would have to marry a man who was going to die so soon. She complained out against fate. Sri Aurobindo wrote that this was such a developed lady, but for a while she fell to the lot of common man, and she cried the common human cry. She asked, "Why is it all? And wherefore are we here? What need had the soul of ignorance and tears? Whence rose the call for sorrow and for pain?" And Narad said, "Pain is the hammer of the gods to break a dead resistance in the human heart, his slow inertia as of living stone. If the heart were not forced to want and weep, his soul would have lain down content, at ease, and never thought to exceed the human start, and never learned to climb towards the sun. The spirit is doomed to pain until man is free. A power came in to veil the eternal light. It is the origin of our suffering here. It binds the earth to calamity and pain. This all must conquer who would bring down God's peace. This is the inner war without escape." In Sri Aurobindo's essay, Thoughts and Glimpses, he writes, "Wherefore God hammers so fiercely at his world, tramples and kneads it like dough, casts it so often into the bloodbath and the red hell heat of the furnace, because humanity in the mass is still a hard, crude, and vile ore, which will not otherwise be smelted and shaped. As is his material, so is his method. Let it help to transmute itself into nobler and purer metal. His ways with it will be gentler and sweeter, much loftier and fairer its uses." Mother said that a small portion of humanity was ready to have its crude ore transformed into pure gold. She said this in 1957 because the supermental forces had come starting in 1956. And then she said, "Why not go through the flame of purification to do this? If we do this, at the same time, our soul will become active in our outer being. It will help the whole process. We have to look at ourselves. we have to see what we really are and purify all our falsehoods so the new forces can transform us into the pure gold of the highest consciousness that can work in the world and release it from misery and suffering and pain. Today, we have very clear descriptions of miseries and sufferings that we might have inside us, many different attitudes, ways of thinking, ways of feeling. Here also, Sri Aurobindo describes things in life which are the bloodbath and the red hell heat of the furnace. In the part of Savitri that we have today, Sri Aurobindo starts to speak about the first of three powers of the soul, three capacities that we have when we have a developed psychic being. He calls them the triple soul forces. We develop our own conscious psychic being by always putting the soul's qualities of love, wisdom, and all the other high soul qualities into our thoughts, into our vital energies and impulses, and into our body and our actions. When we are spiritually developed, these three soul powers act effectively. They act effectively both in us for our continuing transformation into pure gold, and they act also in our world through us, the world that we live in, that we need to change for the better. Sri Aurobindo describes the triple soul forces as three women. They are personifications. Their powers and capacities will be our powers and capacities when our soul consciousness fills our being and guides us. We are also going to see the forces which are still undeveloped. As Sri Aurobindo puts it, they are the hard, crude, and vile expressions of the mass of humanity. These are what we have to change into the higher expressions coming from the soul. When Savitri first listens to the three higher capacities, as represented by the three women, they complain to her that they cannot act fully to help the lower powers to change. They need the soul's connection with the supreme all consciousness and all power to be successful. We will hear the complaint of each of these women, and we will see what they need. Then we will hear the complaint of the negative forces from below, and we will see why they have to change. All through Savitri, Sri Aurobindo describes how hard the life of human beings is. And then he tells us human beings how to fix our problems by aspiring and surrendering to the higher consciousness which is always here and which he describes. He also does this in other poetry. When he was living in Pondicherry, he wrote a poem called The Cosmic Dance. Dance of Krishna, dance of Kali. Krishna is the supreme in this poem. Kali is the divine mother in the form of nature. The natural world we all live in, and which brings us all so many difficulties, until our spiritual development is successful. Kali's dance here expresses the world we live in now and where we are now. The action of Kali brings what we need for spiritual progress when we are still what Sri Aurobindo calls hard, cruel, and vile ore. Sri Aurobindo often wrote about Krishna and Kali working together, because Kali's strong destructive force changes us quickly. We can become ready to receive the new supermental forces that are coming. Here's his poem. The Cosmic Dance. Dance of Krishna. Dance of Kali. Two measures are there of the cosmic dance. Always we hear the tread of Kali's feet, measuring in rhythms of pain and grief and chance, life's game of hazard, terrible and sweet. The ordeal of the veiled initiate, the hero's soul at play with death's embrace, wrestler in the dread gymnasium of fate, and sacrifice, a lonely path to grace. Man's sorrows made a key to the mysteries, truth's narrow road out of time's wastes of dreams, the soul's seven doors from matter's tomb to rise, are the common motives of her tragic theme. But when shall Krishna's dance through nature move, his mask of sweetness, laughter, rapture, love? When we realize our soul, Krishna's dance will be in all that we feel and think and say and do. As Sri Aurobindo writes in the poem, then Krishna will emerge through his mask of nature's dance. Because everything is really a mask of Krishna. The soul force that Savitri meets today is the divine power of compassion. Sri Aurobindo says she is a spirit touched by the grief of all that lives. And she says this to Savitri. She says, to share the suffering of the world I came. I am in all that suffers and that cries. I am the spirit in a world of pain. I carry the fire that can never be quenched, and the compassion that supports the suns. Sri Aurobindo describes her, saying that her heart was riven with the world's agony and burdened with the sorrow and struggle in time. Then, through her speech to Savitri, he describes the suffering and pain in today's world in such a way that our heart is moved by a divine compassion for the painful and difficult and dangerous lives of living beings. Just like this being of compassion and pity, now we want these terrible troubles to change. Mother taught that real knowledge is knowledge by identification. We become one with the object we identify with. Then we really know. The divine compassion we feel with Sri Aurobindo's words is identification. When we're living in our soul, we feel it, we identify, but because our soul with its higher consciousness is there, we are above it at the same time. It doesn't drag us down. It doesn't hurt us. And we can act on it. But now, this patient, caring, long-suffering being of divine compassion and grief complains. She says God gave her love, but he did not give her his force. She has no power to save. She says, nothing refusing of creation's load, I have borne all, and know I still must bear. She's waiting for God to come, and she knows that one day God will come at last. When she stops speaking from below, like the roar of an angry beast, the force of ignorance and anger speaks up about himself and his condition. As Sri Aurobindo writes, that it is the voice of a tortured titan, once a god. It's good for us to know what a titan is, because Sri Aurobindo uses the term often in this canto, and he uses it often throughout Savitri as well. The titan is a being that comes from Hittite mythology, which is even older than the Greek and Roman mythology, and this mythology moved up into the Greek and Roman thought. Titans were ruling gods in those days, but they were overthrown by the gods of Greek mythology, and they were imprisoned, so they could not do any harm. In Book 7, the Book of Fate, Sri Aurobindo describes a titan's behavior. He says, against the law, he pits his single will. Across its way, he throws his pride of might. Heavenward, he clamors on a stair of storms. He dominates the life of common men. His pain and others' pain, he makes his means. On death and suffering he builds his throne. He feeds his strength with his own and others' pain. He sees his little self as very God. His little I has swallowed the whole world. His ego has stretched into infinity. Then Sri Aurobindo cautions against being like a titan. He says, "Take not that stride, O growing soul of man. Cast not thyself into that night of God." We're going to hear that this tortured titan expresses all the things that Sri Aurobindo just described. He shows us that these characteristics are part of man's daily life and thought today. Sri Aurobindo makes a couple of references to titans in history in Greek mythology. So for us to understand this titan and what he says, it's good to know why he says, first of all, "I am Prometheus, and the flame he kindled, burning like a moth." In classic Greek mythology, Prometheus is the titan who created man out of clay. And he was man's greatest benefactor, because he stole fire from the gods for mankind. The gods punished him by tying him to a great rock. Every day, a vulture comes and tears out his liver. But because Prometheus is immortal, he can never die, and the liver comes back each time. He speaks of someone called Enceladus, and he wants Enceladus to rise and bring him strength. Enceladus is a giant, imprisoned by the gods under Mount Etna. Mount Etna was the home of the gods. He is imprisoned there so he cannot do any more destruction. When this titan force of anger speaks from below, he complains that he is the man of sorrows. God built the earth to enjoy his sufferings and miseries. He can't win at anything. He doesn't like anything. And he believes that everything is there to hurt him. He says, "I have lived for myself and not for others' lives." And then he blames his sufferings on God. He blames them on the people around him, on his teachers, and finally, on the way nature made him. He cannot do anything but be himself, and he refuses to change. He must remain what he is. He complains there is no pity, no goodness, no kindness. Even though he himself rejects these things, he says that nobody else has them either. His resistance to divine pity and compassion is a classic example of the ego's resistance to change. He's only going to think about himself. He's never going to consider other people. Mother and Sri Aurobindo teach that self-pity is the worst thing we can feel. This fellow was wallowing in self-pity. He's swimming in it. But finally, we get the feeling that he is enjoying it. Somehow, he likes the way he is. And this is the real reason that he doesn't want to change. In Thoughts and Glimpses, Sri Aurobindo writes that man loves his imperfections. It is our ego that does this. This fellow brags that God has made the world to make him suffer. In a very subtle way, Sri Aurobindo describes the attitudes that cause us to make suffering, pain, and misery for other people. This wrathful titan is the person who gives other people pain and suffering. His attitudes are the attitudes behind man's aggression and behind man's destruction of his fellow man. This is the kind of person who makes war, who destroys other people's cities. This is the kind of person who attacks his fellow man, both physically and psychologically. And it doesn't have to be a general on a battlefield. It doesn't have to be a king or a government official. It could just be the person sitting next to you. It could even be a parent dealing with their own child. Because the point is, it's the attitude. It's how they feel and what they do. This Titan complains that he is the victim. He is in the pain and suffering. And then he very cleverly blames everything and everyone else. He blames God. He blames nature. He blames his fellow man. And he says, therefore, there's nothing he can do. He cannot change. In this way, he turns our attention away from what he might be doing. He puts the blame on everyone else. And then he makes us think that everyone else is doing these things to him. But finally, he is doing these things to himself when he does them to other people. And he is the real cause of his own sufferings. His statements sound so extreme that we would never believe we have these thoughts. We would never have these feelings or attitudes. However, if we keep carefully observing ourselves, we will find them, even if the words we use are different. But they cloud our consciousness just the same. They can be hiding in corners of our consciousness where we don't look, or we don't want to recognize them for what they really are. Sometimes we're just stuck in mechanical habits, which we accept as inevitable parts of ourselves. We don't even realize how miserable we're making ourselves with this. Mother says that sometimes we are hiding them from ourselves because they are precious to us, and we want to keep them. We have to clear the screen of our own consciousness in order to live our daily life with the right attitudes and right actions. Then we live with our soul at the surface of our being. We don't participate anymore in the sufferings and miseries described by the divine soul force of compassion, nor do we have the self-torturing and the negative thoughts and feelings expressed by the ignorant, suffering lower force. Mother says that we can know that our soul is at the surface of our being when we feel peaceful and happy and full of trust, full of a deep, peaceful benevolence and goodwill that stays behind our daily thoughts, feelings, and actions. And with our soul guiding us in the forefront of our consciousness, we can live a balanced life. And when we are free from all the ways we make our own lives miserable, we move on to greater spiritual development. We create the goodness and the joy and the delight, which is the real reason for a being to be here, living in a body in this life. In Mother's talks to the school children about Sri Aurobindo's book, The Life Divine, she said, quote, "But if one goes to the very depth of things, if stripped not only of all egoism, but also of the ego, one gives oneself totally, without reserve, so completely and disinterestedly that one becomes capable of understanding the plan of the Lord. Then one knows that it is not a bad joke. It is not a tortuous path by which you return, a little battered, to the starting point. On the contrary, it is to teach the entire creation the delight of being, the beauty of being, the greatness of being, the majesty of a sublime life, and the perpetual growth, perpetually progressive, of that delight, that beauty, that greatness. Then everything has a meaning. Then one no longer regrets having struggled and suffered. One has only the enthusiasm to realize the divine goal. And one plunges headlong into the realization with the certitude of the goal and the victory. if there ever was a reason for us to do the yoga, to keep on purifying our being of all the miseries, and to go through what we have to go through, this statement of Mother's certainly is a good one. Savitri hears the story of her soul force of divine compassion and pity. She hears the story of its opposite, suffering self-pity. She knows that she has to be living in her soul consciousness for all this to change. She knows that what is needed is the connection to the Supreme, which the soul has as part of its purpose in being here. This soul force of divine compassion has told Savitri that she is Savitri's secret soul. But Savitri knows that she's not. Very quietly and sweetly, Savitri says to her, Madonna of suffering, Mother of grief divine, thou art a portion of my soul, put forth to bear the unbearable sorrow of the world. Because thou art, men yield not to their doom, but ask for happiness and strive with fate. Because thou art, the wretched still can hope. Savitri has understood that so far, this soul force, which she has, and which we all have the power to solace, to comfort. But she doesn't yet have the power to save. And Savitri promises to return and bring her the strength and the force and the wisdom of the eternal. The great caring love of this soul force shall be the bond of humankind, and compassion shall influence all the actions of nature. There shall be peace and joy forevermore. When we saw Savitri last time, she was just going on the narrow path trod only by rare wounded pilgrim feet. And we could feel the silent nearness of the soul. Savitri, the Book of Yoga, The Triple Soul Forces, Part 1. Here, from a low and prone and listless ground, the passion of the first ascent began. A moon-bright face, in a somber cloud of hair, a woman sat in a pale, lustrous robe. A rugged and ragged soil was her bare seat. Beneath her feet, a sharp and wounding stone. A divine pity on the peaks of the world, a spirit touched by the grief of all that lives. She looked out far and saw from inner mind this questionable world of outward things, of false appearances and plausible shapes, this dubious cosmos stretched in the ignorant void, the pangs of earth, the toil and speed of the stars, and the difficult birth and dolorous end of life. Accepting the universe as her body of woe, the mother of the seven sorrows bore the seven stabs that pierced her bleeding heart. The beauty of sadness lingered on her face. Her eyes were dim with the ancient stain of tears. Her heart was riven with the world's agony and burdened with the sorrow and struggle in time. An anguished music trailed in her rapt voice. Absorbed in a deep compassion's ecstasy, lifting the mild ray of her patient gaze in soft, sweet, training words, slowly she spoke. O Savitri, I am thy secret soul. To share the suffering of the world I came. I draw my children's pangs into my breast. I am the nurse of the dolor beneath the stars. I am the soul of all who wailing writhe under the ruthless harrow of the gods. I am woman, nurse, and slave, and beaten beast. I tend the hands that gave me cruel blows. The hearts that spurned my love and zeal, I serve. I am the courted queen, the pampered doll. I am the giver of the bowl of rice. I am the worshipped angel of the house. I am in all that suffers and that cries. Mine is the prayer that climbs in vain from earth. I am traversed by my creature's agonies. I am the spirit in a world of pain. The scream of tortured flesh and tortured hearts fallen back on heart and flesh unheard by heaven has rent with helpless grief and wrath my soul. I have seen the peasant burning in his hut. I have seen the slashed corpse of the slaughtered child, heard woman's cry ravished and stripped and hailed amid the bayings of the hellhound mob. I have looked on. I had no power to save. I had brought no arm of strength to aid or slay. God gave me love. He gave me not his force. I have shared the toil of the yoked animal drudge, pushed by the goad, encouraged by the whip. I have shared the fear-filled life of bird and beast, its long hunt for the day's precarious food, its covert slink and crouch and hungry prowl, its pain and terror seized by beak and claw. I have shared the daily life of common men, its petty pleasures and its petty cares, its press of troubles and haggard hoard of ills, earth's trail of sorrow, hopeless of relief, the unwanted, tedious labor without joy, and the burden of misery and the strokes of fate. I have been pity, leaning over pain, and the tender smile that heals the wounded heart, and sympathy making life less hard to bear. Man has felt near my unseen face and hands. I have become the sufferer and his moan. I have lain down with the mangled and the slain. I have lived with the prisoner in his dungeon cell. Heavy on my shoulders weighs the yoke of time. Nothing refusing of creation's load, I have borne all, and know I still must bear. Perhaps, when the world sinks into a last sleep, I too may sleep in dumb eternal peace. I have borne the calm indifference of heaven, watched nature's cruelty to suffering things while God passed silent by, nor turned to help. Yet have I cried not out against his will, yet have I not accused his cosmic law. Only to change this great hard world of pain, a patient prayer has risen from my breast. A pallid resignation lights my brow. Within me, a blind faith and mercy dwell. I carry the fire that never can be quenched, and the compassion that supports the suns. I am the hope that looks towards my God who never came to me till now. His voice I hear that ever says, I come. I know that one day he shall come at last. She ceased, and like an echo from below, answering her pathos of divine complaint, a voice of wrath took up the dire refrain. A growl of thunder, or roar of angry beast, the beast that crouching growls within man's depths, voice of a tortured titan, once a god. I am the man of sorrows. I am he who is nailed on the wide cross of the universe. To enjoy my agony, God built the earth. My passion he has made his drama's theme. He has sent me naked into his bitter world and beaten me with his rods of grief and pain that I might cry and grovel at his feet and offer him worship with my blood and tears. I am Prometheus under the vulture's beak, man, the discoverer of the undying fire in the flame he kindled, burning like a moth. I am the seeker who can never find. I am the fighter who can never win. I am the runner who never touched his goal. Hell tortures me with the edges of my thought. Heaven tortures me with the splendor of my dreams. What profit have I of my animal birth? What profit have I of my human soul? I toil like the animal die. I am man the rebel, man the helpless serf. Fate and my fellows cheat me of my wage. I loosen with my blood my servitude's seal, and shake from my aching neck the oppressor's knees, only to seat new tyrants on my back. My teachers lesson me in slavery. I am shown God's stamp and my own signature upon the sorry contract of my fate. I have loved, but none has loved me since my birth. My fruit of works is given to other hands. All that is left me is my evil thoughts, my sordid quarrel against God and man, envy of the riches that I cannot share, hate of a happiness that is not mine. I know my fate will ever be the same. It is my nature's work that cannot change. I have loved for mine, not for the beloved's sake. I have lived for myself, and not for others' lives. Each in himself is soul by nature's law. So God has made his harsh and dreadful world. So has he built the petty heart of man. Only by force and ruse can man survive. For pity is a weakness in his breast. His goodness is a laxity in the nerves. His kindness an investment for return. His altruism is ego's other face. He serves the world that him the world may serve. If once the Titan's strength could wake in me, if Enceladus from Etna could arise, I then would reign, the master of the world, and like a god, enjoy man's bliss and pain. But God has taken from me the ancient force. There is a dull consent in my sluggish heart, a fierce satisfaction with my special pangs, as if they made me taller than my kind. Only by suffering can I excel. I am the victim of titanic ills. I am the doer of demoniac deeds. I was made for evil. Evil is my lot. Evil I must be, and by evil live. Not other can I do but be myself. What nature made me, that I must remain. I suffer and toil and weep. I moan and hate. And Savitri heard the voice, the echo heard, and turning to her being of pity spoke. Madonna of suffering, mother of grief divine, thou art a portion of my soul, put forth to bear the unbearable sorrow of the world. Because thou art, men yield not to their doom, but ask for happiness and strive with fate. Because thou art, the wretched still can hope. But thine is the power to solace, not to save. One day I will return, a bringer of strength, and make thee drink from the Eternal's cup. His streams of force shall triumph in thy limbs, and wisdom's calm control thy passionate heart. Thy love shall be the bond of humankind, compassion the bright key of nature's acts. Misery shall pass, abolished from the earth. The world shall be freed from the anger of the beast, from the cruelty of the Titan and his pain. There shall be peace and joy forevermore.